You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
If you're looking for words that mean so many things that they're hard to use in mixed company, you'd do well to start with socialism and socialist. To be sure, the distortions of presidential campaigns and AM radio do their part to muddy the waters, but there is some genuine and some intense complexity in the history of socialism itself. Gary Dorian's recent book, American Democratic Socialism from Yale University Press, digs into the moments and the people and the movements, particular and peculiar to the United States, that turn that complexity up. And Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome him to the show. Thank you for joining us, Gary.
Thank you, Nathan. I'm glad to be with you.
Before we start with my questions, I want our listeners to know that this is a rich 200-year political and social and intellectual history of America. And in this talk, we're going to focus on a few episodes that interest me the most, but you listeners definitely need to go and get your hands on a copy of this volume. There's far more than an hour-long talk can engage. Now, Gary, with that on the table, I want you to set the stage for what we're going to discuss today with a few words about your first page. You write that there are at least two visions of a good society that have animated the American Republic. One of those is a right libertarian image, and the other one is a left socialist image. In brief, what gives us Americans that double vision, and how does that duality shape this volume of history?
Well, I think that virtually every presidential debate of a campaign of the 20th century and well into the 21st century has been some version of that debate that I capsulized immediately, that there are just two quite different sort of concepts of just what sort of society the U.S. should try to be. And one is just favoring that view of just individual freedom on steroids, wherever it takes you, as much of that as you can get, whether it takes a more libertarian form, or as I also said, it can take a right nationalist form. And of course, that's the direction we've gone in recent years. But the vision of a kind of free minds and free markets where you're not giving any sort of title or purpose to the government besides merely national security and maybe deliver the mail. That's just sort of a powerful theme in American political discourse all through the 20th century. It's firing virtually every presidential campaign on one side. It's fired by a libertarianism that is itself impossible. It's never really in play, and yet it is the thing driving more, shall we say, prosaic or pedestrian forms of politics. And then the same thing happens on the left, that you have sort of mildly sort of progressive liberal democratic discourses that are dominant in American politics all through the 20th century. And yet I think there is underneath them this sort of the true believers, the people who have the most conviction, who hang in there and have just a very, very different vision of what a good society could be, are in many respects just the opposite of that, you know, that right vision. And so here, what I'm just playing out right away in the first paragraph is just the dissonance, the distance between, and also the, in some ways, unacknowledged import of a quite libertarian vision on one hand and a quite democratic socialist vision on the other, that are never what's elected, and yet these are sort of ideological discourses that for long have fired so much of our political discourse. So it's just sort of a framing, you know, device to just say, you know, here's there are debates about to be engaged in this text that are going to sound familiar and carry us through. And in fact, they've been there for a very long time. These aren't new debates. Now, of course, the really new development is how in recent years, the libertarian discourse in the Republican Party has been taken over by, I think, you know, a right nationalist discourse. That was quite a stunning development. These constellations of things have always been there. Both of these parties have got all kinds of things under the hood. And yet I think there is something that has been driving it for most of our recent history that has in fact changed of late.
And I want to start with just how far this goes back. So I'm tempted to ask you about Robert Owen, since I'm from Indiana and he's our second most famous socialist. But we'll get to the big one in due course. So I'm going to start with another 19th century figure that Indiana likes to claim. We like to claim a lot of famous people. And that's Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Because his iconography in the 20th century, when I grew up, made him out to be our own homegrown Stoic emperor, complete with copper coins and a memorial with marble columns. When I read about his encounters with German socialists, it took me aback. So how did the spirit of 1848 make its way to America, to Lincoln's acquaintance and otherwise?
Well, firstly, you know, Abraham Lincoln is such a colossal figure and did so much good and has certain human qualities that are very attractive that just virtually everybody wants to claim him. I mean, once this reputational thing gets rolling, which incidentally didn't really occur until we're out of the 19th century. You know, Ulysses S. Grant, far greater figure in the later 19th century than Lincoln. But once Carl Sandburg and others sort of went to work, and Lincoln becomes this colossal figure who transcends all others, well, now everybody needs to claim him. And of course, there are things in him where, you know, that's possible. So that's just the first thing to say about that. So socialists are far from the only ones who do this, but they did do it, and they had you know, considerable claim. It's not like they're just making this all up. There were socialists straight from Germany. A lot of them called 48ers, who are exiles from the revolutions in Europe, especially in Germany. And some of them did some prison time, you know, after all these bourgeois revolutions were overthrown in 1848, 1849. And so we had this whole stream of what were called 48ers who came to the United States as refugees or exiles. And they're socialists belonging to, you know, German, you know, social democratic formations. And some of them are Marxists who know their Marxism. Some of them know Karl Marx personally, like Joe Wiedemeyer and Carl Schutz. And there's this whole band of folks who ended up being among the founders of the Republican Party. You know, Lincoln knew them. And they, you know, they have a close sort of relationship to, certainly to Lincoln, just by virtue of the fact that they are among the founders of the Republican Party. And to them, the connection between slavery and capitalism just couldn't be clearer. That's what you need to be working on if you come to this country, which they did. These are now the same people, some of them, who ended up building the Socialist Labor Party later in the 19th century. And so they have kind of a stump speech. It's part of their shtick to say, you know, Lincoln was almost one of us. We knew him. And he was more like us than he could ever let on. And they would point to those elements, that sort of right versus wrong argument that Lincoln would give on the stump. And just as Lincoln had the soul of an abolitionist, but he certainly cannot be an abolitionist and run for president. So also, he really had the soul of a socialist. We recognize it when we see it, although, of course, he could never come out as that either. So socialists said this all through the 19th century. And there were people like, George Slater just took this as far as you can. George Slater was a prominent Black social gospel socialist of the late 19th, early 20th century, a protege of George W. Woodbey, wrote for the Christian Socialist Magazine. And he took this as far as you can and said, you know, hey, flat out, he said, no, Lincoln was a socialist. We need to get Lincoln right while it's still time. Now, you know, there's wishful projection in there. And in some ways, Slater undercut what I think might have been even his own influence by just overdoing the Lincoln theme. It was like, you know, he's trying to put one over on us. But this is a real thing in the whole socialist story.
And I want to pick up on one of the relationships you narrated just now, and that is between what I'm going to call sort of imported European socialism and then homegrown American socialism. Because one dynamic that also caught me by surprise is the talk in the 19th century labor movement, especially about how the Marxists especially, but other European socialists as well, are kind of college professor stuff. But American socialism, I mean, that's working people socialism. How prevalent was that tension in the 19th century?
Well, it's a tension, but it's also just the lay of the land, that people are coming into these movements from different places. And you have this tradition of radical democracy, of a kind of radical liberalism in the American story from the beginning. I mean, these are people who sort of fought for their rights to just believe what they actually believed and aren't going to bow to any authority. So that kind of radical antinomian strain of an ethical radicalism, that's just part of the mother's milk of the United States. I mean, that is the radical tradition that's homegrown in the US. And so then as that thing goes forward, and a lot of those people, of course, are early abolitionists who've got sort of moral reasons for being abolitionists, and they don't really have a unifying name for all the things that they're for. They just call themselves radicals or antinomians or, you know, any such thing. Or working party was such a thing. You know, the first workers' party ever created in this country was in the United States in 1829. So as that tradition goes forward, and now it's not, you don't really get into about the 1850s. You don't get people in that group start to say, well, you know, actually socialism could be the name that it's the thing that names all the things I'm for. It's feminism and abolition and everybody, all working people getting their rights and having some control over the means of production that these giant workbenches that they work under and so on. That if there is such a thing as a name that sort of holds together all the things that various kind of radicals believe in the 19th century, well, you know, maybe socialism would be the name for that. That you see people coming to that verdict in the 1850s and 60s. And so then you get something already forming long before there's a socialist party in this country, long before the socialist party per se existed, because that's not till 1901. Who are, saying that would be the name of our desire. And of course, they're coming from all kinds of places. So from very early on, and then even more so as this story goes along, American democratic socialism is just this extraordinary cultural stew of various kinds of traditions that are unlike what socialism is anywhere else in the world. You've got the whole cultural history and breadth of what was the Socialist International in Europe that is not only replicated but then exceeded by what became socialism in the United States. So to put this in shorthand, the United States has the richest cultural history of democratic socialism in the world and has from you know the 1870s on.
And if you don't believe that, you can even go to Terre Haute, Indiana. And I want you to talk a little bit about Indiana's most famous socialist now, Terre Haute's own Eugene Debs. You write about his threefold message of class struggle, personal liberty, and virtue in ways that would likely surprise those who think that libertarians like those from the Acton Institute are the only ones concerned with virtue and liberty. So how do those pieces fit in the work of Eugene Debs, and how do they fit a broader socialist vision of a good society?
Well, firstly, there was never a truer believer in American liberty than Eugene Debs. I mean, he's just, born to it, and he just couldn't be, couldn't be more American, he couldn't be more Midwestern than he is. And people see it and hear it in him. Out on the stump. He just dearly loves his country and has no complaint at all with its emphasis on individual liberty and your right to believe what you'll want. Even the sort of the inherently American radical tradition that is just mother's milk to him, that is this kind of radical antinomian individualism. The early feminists, people like that, abolitionists who have that sort of character, that's his group. I mean, he identifies with them emotionally and intellectually long before he talks himself into socialism. You know, they had to destroy his industrial union before Debs finally said, well, I guess I'm a socialist too. But he is that kind of American radical, just bred to the bone American, in that radical democratic tradition with an ethical base, long before he's ever trying to read Karl Marx, and he never did read very much of Karl Marx, and trying to associate himself with, you know, these Europeans who've sort of created something that, you know, Americans have just taken baby steps toward. So that's who Debs was long before he became a socialist. And of course, in organizational terms and in terms of just his work life, who he was long before he finally, you know, becomes a socialist in 1897, he is the epitome of a craft unionist. And they thought so, that he was just the best kind of craft unionist. As craft unionism is the type of unionism in which you're developing a kind of fraternal society that organizes around a specific function. So, you know, railroad engineers, you know, that's a craft, or whatever. Any industry that's got different kinds of functions. It's right. The workers.
Textile workers or things like that as well. Indeed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, now when you get into the textile, that can be a little different thing. Cause then
that's true.
That can go industrial, and it did. That's why I needed to interrupt right there, because it's not craft unionism was truly specific, for it's just something so specific that it's then just the workers in that particular function that are organizing around it and developing a fraternal society. And the beginning of it, it's always the same kind of beginning. You're just trying to create a pension fund in dangerous occupations, where now when someone's maimed or you know, died prematurely, there's some kind of pension for, you know, the survivors of that worker. That's how they all start. But the problem with craft unionism is that, of course, since it's so oriented toward a craft, and that craft can become a highly skilled thing, there are sort of exclusive kind of divide and conquer boundaries that build up around it. And the more powerful crafts are the ones that require more skill. And then they become more sort of provincial and insular. Only people like us need apply. And so we did develop a type of unionism in this country that's predominantly craft unionism. And most of those craft unions were racist and sexist and xenophobic. No Asians need apply. They've got all these rules about who they don't want in their club. And then the whole class thing enters as well, because the more powerful craft unions are the ones that are the more skilled. And so you have people who make more in the more exclusive sort of crafts. And of course, that's where Debs began, because that's all they have here in Indiana. When he starts out, he starts out with the engineers. He's a railway craft unionist and works his way up in that. And he loved the workers, and they loved him back. And he was totally devoted to them. He helped to build the firemen's union right up to the point where he just said, "This is not working." I mean, he doesn't believe in it anymore. He can see he's fighting the racism in it and fighting the nativism that's in it. And also just sees that it's not succeeding on its own terms, that the only way unionism really gets somewhere in this country beyond what it was, it's got to be industrial unionism, where you're organizing all the workers in a given industry. But the problem there is that the only real breakthrough in that is it's mine workers and textile workers, brewery workers in Milwaukee. Those are the three big exceptions. And then he tried to make an exception, the railway. That was the great push in 1895 to try to create a strong industrial union in the rail industry, which is, of course, just the biggest industry in the whole country. And that when the government smashed his industrial union and he realizes, wow, they're just never going to let us do it. That's when he became a socialist. But he's got all that just quintessentially American experience, not just behind him, but in him. And it's what one of the things that just made him a fabulous campaigner for his whole career.
Right. And I want to follow up on one distinction that is emerging here. First of all, you know, thank you for the clarification on the distinction between craft unionism and industrial unionism. Those are certainly different. But I think another important distinction is that between unionism more broadly and the political party that we call socialist. So, I mean, you know, does one simply grow out of the limits of the other, or do they grow up in parallel? How do those two faces relate to each other? Because again, you know, I'm in my mid 40s. So, I mean, you know, in my childhood, you know, as far as Reagan was concerned, any kind of union was socialist. But you're making a distinction between the political party and the unions. What was the nature of that distinction in those early days in the 19th century?
Yes. You know, the usual story in Europe is that the Socialist Party is just a party formation that represents some powerful union or group of unions. I mean, there's just no question that what's driving the socialist parties, the social democratic parties in Europe, is some organized worker formation underneath it. And sometimes these things just come virtually together. They virtually are the same thing. Although there's some distinction where, you know, the parties do their distinct work. And, you know, Karl Marx from the beginning thought that, oh, this socialism is going to have a very hard time in the United States because that formation does not exist. The Socialist Party it does have a bunch of industrial unionists who are in the AFL, the American Federation of Labor. So it's not like that's lacking. It is there to a degree. However, the great challenge of all the challenges that American socialism had in this period, and I mean all of them, roast beef and apple pie, expanding frontier, a constitution that pretty much guarantees a two-party fiefdom system, you know, all these other issues that we have for third-party political movements. They're all significant, but by far the biggest thing, the biggest problem that American democratic socialism had is just the kind of unionism that existed in this country, that it's mostly craft unionism. That when the AFL was founded in 1886, it's a federation of all overwhelmingly of craft unions that already have this kind of divide and conquer mentality, where unionism is not the thing that's actually unifying workers. It's unionism becomes an instrument that divides workers from each other, certainly is dividing them from each other politically. And the Socialist Party is a group of people coming from different traditions who are founding a party, but they're not founded on the AFL or even any part of it. To the contrary, they're against most of it. In fact, Debs is in for many years had a bitter confrontation, a fight with the people in his own party who were leaders in the AFL. Because he just thinks the AFL is just a total sellout, right? You can't build socialism on that. That kind of unionism will just pull you under, and we'll never have socialism at all. So he's in a fight for many years, back when it mattered, with the leaders in his own party who are themselves part of the AFL. So the fact that there's such tensions, such a break, between what unionism is in the United States and then the party formations that drive socialism is just the biggest problem of all. It's the problem for the Socialist Labor Party, the group that existed before Debs, for the Socialist Party. And then when they found the Socialist Party itself in 1901, it's, you know, this problem is just always there. I should just say one more thing.
Yeah, by all means.
It's not like this is just the fix is in and nothing can be done about this, because there were The leaders of the industrial unions within the AFL, they are in fact trying to create something closer to what, you know, those European socialist parties are like. They are making the argument within the AFL to say, you know, Samuel Gompers just should not be our leader. We should have a socialist leader, and we should be in alignment with, you know, the Socialist Party, and we should be a group that's sort of advocating what unions do in Europe, the whole agenda. That's what we should be. So that vote is always being pressed. Max Hayes was the leader of it. For 20 years, he pushed this argument in the American Federation of Labor. And as I say, they had some sizable unions at their backing, the miners, the brewery workers, the garment workers in New York. However, they never got over 38%. That's their ceiling. They just never get there. They're close to that point in the mid 1890s. That's still where they are in 1908. They're still having this argument in 1918. And finally, the people who just keep losing this argument ended up trying to form their own labor party in 1920. But then that didn't work either.
Well, I want to back up just a little bit from 1920, because one of the great crisis moments this book tells is 1917, when you get actually it was before 1917, but it's that decade when you get the 1-2 punch of the Great War on one hand and the Bolshevik Revolution on the other hand. And with the former, nationalism overruns the left's anti-war and internationalist convictions without a whole lot of resistance. And then with the other, socialism stops being the most American thing one can imagine and becomes the face of the great Russian menace. Yeah. So what kinds of fundamental changes overtake the American left in the wake of these two things, and what things stay constant?
All right, thanks, Nathan. I think, let me do a prefatory thing before we do, and then I'll just go straight for that question. What I just wanna make sure I can sort of get said here is that, you know, this book is a comprehensive history of the entire, you know, political and intellectual history of American democratic socialism. It is the first book ever written that really tries to do that. And secondly, the other thing I got to make sure I just even say here about it, it's also the only book that's ever been done in this literature that holds together the intertwined secular and religious traditions of democratic socialism. So that kind of intertwining of these two things always coming together in a zig and zag, that's always there as well. So if people could get the impression, oh, this is just that usual secular story. And actually, No.
We're going to get to some religious questions.
It's fun to make sure I kind of wedge that one.
Oh, yeah, no, but duly noted, sir. Duly noted, sir.
All right, well, this 1917, 1918 business. You know, the glory run for the Socialist Party is that period from 1901 to 1917. That's the Debs period. You know, in 1912, he got 6% of the vote. He is outdrawing the three other people he's running against for president that year. I mean, that's the year that you had Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and Robert Taft all running. They're all claiming some purchase on the progressive vote. Progressivism is so big, so huge in 1912 that everybody running for president is trying, you know, is vying for progressive votes, including the person who's, you know, got the so-called Progressive Party flag, you know, Teddy Roosevelt. Well, Eugene Debs would not say, oh, I'm for progressivism, because, you know, he's not like that. He'd say, no, socialism is really something. And yet, of course, he's getting a lot of those progressive votes as well. So such an extraordinary run that this was in that period of history. And then the thing does just get smashed from two sides. And firstly, it's the first thing that you mentioned in this question. The Socialist Party USA, that party of Eugene Debs, was the only organization of a national scope that had the courage and the wherewithal to say in 1917, no, we are not changing from where we were 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we had all these wishy-washy liberals and progressives who were right there with us saying we need to stay out of this war. And doing so in classic anti-imperialist fashion. This is not a later argument that World War I is all about imperialism. That's what American opponents of the war said all through 1914, 15, 16. And then Wilson takes us into the war in 1917, and everybody just capitulated. You had all these liberal social gospel ministers who had been saying right up to the day before yesterday, we must not go to war, this war is imperialist, and so on. And they turned right on a dime and now gave sermons on making the world safe for democracy and running up Wilson's 14 points and all of it. The one group that held out and said, we are not going for that. This war is just as imperialist today as it was a year ago, was the Socialist Party. Now, firstly, they lost almost all their intellectuals when they did that. So even the whole brain trust of intellectuals who were in the Socialist Party, even most of them took the exit when the party stood four and square against intervening in the war. They just said, we can't have this. We're going for Wilsonian idealism. So there was this terrible drain within the party. That's only like 100 people. The bulk of people who knew why they were in this, they're not gonna leave for that reason, just because the intellectuals are heading for the exits. But the Socialist Party took a vicious pounding, battering, was the punishment that they took for taking this brave stand against the war might have been enough just by itself to destroy them. I mean, I'm talking now about, you know, the Palmer Raids and the Red Scare and just everything we associate with everything that happened in this country on throwing all the Reds in prison. Eugene Debs himself ended up in prison as a federal prisoner as a consequence of all of this. So that just, you just could not exaggerate the sheer repressive force of the US federal government in smashing the Socialist Party, just as this same entity had done a great deal to smash industrial unionism every time it really sort of got a beachhead somewhere. So that's the first thing. But then the second thing, of course, is that what came out of that whole, within that whole period, is the Bolshevik Revolution. And all socialists were thrilled when the Bolsheviks took over in Russia, except, you know, it turned out in a way that isn't what most of them intended at all, certainly not the democratic socialists. They have just this terrible fear that now, and dread that sort of takes them over when they see how the Bolshevik Revolution is running in a Leninist line that's just another kind of left-wing dictatorship. And now that's forming a Comintern, a kind of world, global, communist tradition, formation that is now going to be a rival of what had been the Democratic Socialist Parties, that is the parties of the Second International. Now you have a Third International, and that's communism. And now you got social democracy against communism. And as that happens, that the whole development, the whole kind of soaring buildup, the creation of a world sort of communism centered in Moscow that seems to be the real thing to young people who are just entering these radical stories. And it just feels like, oh, you know, social democrats, they're a bunch of dentists, right? They're very prosaic, they're kind of boring. But the communists, they're the ones, you know, they're the ones who are exciting. They got Leon Trotsky and Lenin and people like that. And that had an impact. And so this group of socialists who are just trying to hold together their party that's being bashed by the government. Now, democratic socialism, it's like communism was like a meteor just smashing into the socialist world and just blowing it apart. And that's not too strong an image for what happened to the Socialist Party in 1918, 1919. And of course, by the time this happened, Eugene Debs is in prison. So, you know, it takes him a while to even figure out what's happening. And emotionally, he had to go from one side to the other because for, you know, when he entered prison, he was just utterly thrilled that the Bolsheviks have taken over and Russia. And he thinks this is just great for socialism. And by the time he gets out of prison, he knows too much about, you know, how this is actually going and can see the writing on the wall for what it means to, for socialism. And of course, that's the end point of entry to, you know, Norman Thomas socialism, 40 years of that.
Right, right. And it's not Thomas I want to focus on for the next few minutes, but it's another figure who kind of bridges that intellectual religious side of this story and the political side of that story. And that's Reinhold Niebuhr. And he is fascinating to me in general, but in this book in particular, he is someone who is unapologetically socialist. And also, I mean, just seems more eager than anyone else in this volume to back every American invasion of a foreign nation if he thinks that there might be communism to fight. So, you know, I mean, some of our listeners, you know, might know him as the theologian that David Brooks and Barack Obama talked about in the 2008 presidential campaign trail. But what about Niebuhr and his kind of socialism in those spans when he presented himself as socialist, which I realize also wasn't consistent? What is it that made him such a ready backer of every possible American military invasion?
Well, Niebuhr is a larger than life figure. He is the colossal figure in the field that I teach, social ethics. And of course I wear his name around my neck because I, you know, I sit in the Reinhold Niebuhr Chair at Union. So
yes, indeed.
and there are certain things that always mark Niebuhr. I think this is just the first thing to say about Niebuhr. He did change his politics every 10 years. And he is deeply political. So there is always this zig and zag to just have to track when you deal with Niebuhr. People will say things about Niebuhr and they almost always you have to say, well, wait a minute, which one are you talking about? You know, who's the essential Niebuhr to you that you're talking about?
It's like Wittgenstein with the volume turned up.
Yeah, yes. You have a really significant change of direction for Niebuhr quite literally in every decade, in the teens, in the 20s, and the 30s, and the 40s, and the 50s, even in the 60s. He's making some very considerable turn. So that's just the first thing you just have to deal with him. Secondly, especially going pertinent to your question, there are certain things that are just always the same. He is the same person all the time. He's the same deeply political person. Reinhold Niebuhr got up every morning asking himself, what should the federal government be doing today? The kind of Christian ethicist he is a Christian ethicist who asks that question, for whom that's the guiding, you know, issue for him. And then he gets this political zig and zag because of, you know, how he ends up differently answering that question. But there are things in that question beyond just the sheer political aspect to it, the deeply patriotic pro-Americanism. And that partly comes from being, you know, his father is a German immigrant. Came to this country to avoid being, you know, drafted into Bismarck's army in Germany. And Reinhold Niebuhr grew up speaking a mishmash of German and English. Start the sentence in English and finish it in German, or the other way around. And isn't really strong in either language because, you know, that's just the milieu he grew up in. And so then he has this sort of struggle to become American, to become even more American than his father. His father is already, he's a minister who's on this Americanization trail, but he's nonetheless growing up at this evangelical reform world in the Midwest, Indiana and Illinois, and then goes to Yale and meets all these Yankees who are just give him a different kind of sense of who he, you know, what the cultural possibilities are. Serves this ENR, Evangelical Reformed Church in Detroit, that's way more Germanic than he is. And so all of this works on him. Niebuhr is, his entire career is a love affair with his country, and needing to not just approve his Americanness, To be a kind of apostle of its interests and wedding the best kind of Christianity to a certain rendering of the American story. For all the zig and zag, for all the different kind of theologizing, for all the zig and zag with parties and socialism and vital center, Democratic Party, mainstream stuff, and Cold War, for all the rest of it, that dynamic with Niebuhr is always there. And it is the key to your question, beyond just the fact that the guy's brilliant. And he's always looking to bring people in his direction. He's just one of these sort of powerful types who he changes his mind a lot, and he has a tendency to say the people who aren't with me now, well, they're stupid, right? Even the people who are saying the very thing he was saying just 5 years ago, no, he always calls them stupid and naive once he's moved to some other position. But this kind of bristling, very masculine Christian social activism is always in him, and it is the thing that drives him through all these different moves in his political career. So, you know, in the 19-teens, he wants to get in the war, and he's getting to be an American. So the first article that Niebuhr wrote for a national magazine, he's calling out German Americans, saying they're not good enough Americans and they need to become better Americans. That's the key to so much of Niebuhr. And then in the early 1920s, now he's starting to become embarrassed about all those pro-war sermons he gave in 1917 and 18, because that's the trend in liberal Protestantism anyway. His whole generation of liberal Protestant ministers who gave saving the world for democracy sermons in 1917 and 1918, by 1919, 1920, they were ashamed of them. Harry Emerson Fosdick said those sermons were atrocious. He spent the rest of his life repenting for cheerleading for the war. And Reinhold Niebuhr, of all people, was one such person. He was actually a pacifist all through the 1920s and into the 1930s, or at least trying to be a pacifist. It's hard in his case. But then when he broke from that, well, now he's on the trail of then what became the latter part of your question. Because he is now always trying for the rest of his career, he is always mobilizing what he considers to be sentimental, naive, liberal, idealistic Christians to defend their country and, defeat the Nazis, and he's right about that, overcome their sentimental idealism in order to do the right thing, in order to get justice. When he first makes that argument, he's a Marxist. You know, he's a Christian Marxist in the 1930s. In the 1940s, he drops Marxism. Now he's an FDR, middle of the Democratic Party, vital center guy. And yet he says the same similar kind of thing about how we really need to relate to national security. And then, of course, later than that, he's a quintessential Cold Warrior, except then he's going to have criticisms about how that turned down as all. So Niebuhr is just always fascinating. For every decade turn in this whole story, there's actually more of Niebuhr in this book than I had meant to put in there. I was not thinking when I started out I was going to have it as much Niebuhr as I do. But the thing is, just over and over, he expresses what's going on in the politics of the time and the relation of democratic socialism to progressivism. He expresses it better than anybody, even better than Norman Thomas through that period. So there ended up being more of Reinhold Niebuhr in this book than I really had meant to put in there.
Very good. Well, I mean, as you have said, and as I have said, I mean, this is a comprehensive history. So once again, listeners, be sure to get a hold of a copy of this. I want to give you a moment here to talk a little bit about the socialism of Rustin and King and other figures in what histories that I've usually read simply call the civil rights movement. I think you make a good case that we do well to understand this as a synthesis of anti-racism and socialism. But one of the fascinating moments that I'd like to hear you comment on a little bit is that Dr. King himself wanted to educate America about the differences between Soviet communism and democratic socialism. But the people around him said, you cannot do that. Talk about that moment. Cause like I said, that was a fascinating story to me.
Oh, thanks, Nathan. Well, I have already, just before this book, I wrote two massive volumes on the Black social gospel tradition. And now there's a third one that will come out next year. So that's on sort of both sides of this book. For my entire career, I have known that there was an important tradition of the Black social gospel rooted in Black and AME and AME Zion and National Baptist Convention churches that just isn't written up. That is just unknown and wrongly so. One way of getting to it is just ask yourself the question, where did Martin Luther King Jr. come from? So much of our literature, it's just like he came from nowhere, and which is so wrong. Now, my own personal history, I came into this by virtue of knowing Michael Harrington and knowing Bayard Rustin and knowing these people who were in King's circle, who knew about King's socialism and the like. So I started my career knowing that there's a Black social gospel tradition, part of which, in fact, the best part of which was actually Christian socialist, that doesn't have any literature, that people haven't written about. And for the many years of my career, I was just trying to get somebody else to write this story. I thought, I'm not the kind of person, I'm not the one who should be writing this, should be somebody else. And so I sprinkled versions of this argument into various books over the years. And then finally I got to Union Theological Seminary and my, closest friend here, James Cohn, just said, Gary, it's your obsession. Just write it up. We need you to just tell the whole story. So now that, we do have now this, I've told the whole story, running back to the 1870s. About the Black social gospel tradition that is itself, it begins with these Black church leaders simply having to ask themselves in the 1870s, now that abolition has come and gone, and even Reconstruction has come and gone, what would a new abolitionism be? What would it be now? What would abolition be in our context? Our context in which we're losing the 14th and 15th Amendments, they're being eviscerated. We've got this mania of lynching going on, and we don't have protest organizations that fight the battles of our time. That's the Black social gospel. And sometimes, it's alignment in some cases with the white social gospel. And in both cases, there's a socialist stream. There's a socialist stream of the white social gospel, and there's a socialist stream in the Black social gospel. And in the Black social gospel, that's people like Reverend E. Ransom and George Woodbe and George Slater and the ministers in the orbit of W.B. Du Bois and going from that generation out, that's Mordecai Johnson and Benjamin Mays and Howard Thurman and J. Pius Barber. And that's the line that takes you to Martin Luther King, because the last four people I just named, they were King's, mentors, is the people who mentored him in the faith and in who he was. So all those people I just named, they're all explicitly socialists. I mean, they know who they are. And they can quote Walter Rauschenbusch chapter and verse. Benjamin Mays, King's mentor, edited a book on Rauschenbusch. But of course, King is the leader of a national civil rights movement. And so these people who were my mentors, and I started out, people like Harrington and others are in that orbit. This is just very, very important to them that we got to keep the socialism stuff down. It will destroy everything. If people find out that Martin Luther King is an outright socialist, that'll destroy the civil rights movement.
Now, in your view, real quick, Is that mainly because of Cold War pressures, or were there other factors that would have made that so destructive?
Firstly, there is the case that it is a hard thing in an African-American context to take on socialism as well. It's hard enough just being Black in this country. And this is always the argument against this whole stream of people who go for socialism too. So, that's firstly the backstory. But secondly, yes, the Cold War is just nullifying. We can't introduce a rhetoric, a language about socialism even though King's inner circle in New York City, of the people that he is in contact with, his inner circle of people like Harrington and Rustin and Randolph and James Farmer, that whole group that is his, you know, his inner circle in New York City, they're all socialists. And they're all out, but we can't have Martin Luther King. What he did, I think the sort of the key to his genius, there was actually two different civil rights movements, and the thing linking them is personal. It's Martin Luther King himself. He is the link between this mostly this northern established New York City movement that you know built the NAACP. And which had a bunch of socialists in it from the beginning, and this now new kind of Southern, mostly younger, very clerical, very church-based group that became the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. King is the link between those two things. And we can't have a successful civil rights movement if he gets smoked out as a democratic socialist. So he'll talk about it, you know, at the meetings of the SCLC. He gave very frank talks about even saying, I want to be able to talk about democratic socialism, right? It's the missing thing. We end up just coming off as this middle-class movement, this middle-class reform movement, if we can't talk about what really matters. But as close as he could come to doing that, he's just saying, well, we got to at least show that we're a poor people's movement. We got to build a poor people's campaign. Because they keep typing us as though we're just a middle-class reform movement, and we're not. But we're hamstrung by the fact that we can't talk about Christian socialism.
And I want to follow up on that, because by the time I was an undergraduate in the mid to late 1990s, the history of Dr. King just simply involved his socialism. I mean, it was simply a fact that we read about at the college level. I mean, was that always part of the academic history of King's movement, or did that change at some point so that, you know, by the 90s, that would have been the case, but maybe in the 1970s, it wouldn't have been yet?
Well, there was always a trickle of academics who knew it and wrote a little bit about it. I mean, you know, I'm one of them.
I know you are.
before that, you know, if you look at a book like Michael Harrington's, what's that book that's got the word Fragments of the Century? He wrote about it. That's, I think, 1972 and so on. So certainly there are kind of crumbs like that when people would write their memoirs or write about this topic per se. You know, you would get this little bit of storytelling about how, you know, Dr. King really was a democratic socialist and I was in a position to know it. There is that sort of breadcrumbs. But you are right, Nathan. In terms of the big histories that people read that now you would read in a college course that's just devoted to, say, the civil rights movement or something like that, the real breakthrough texts there are, it's the Garrow book, Bending the Cross. That was 1986. Taylor Branch's work as well, the first volume of his trilogy. Those are the two books that are big fat sort of histories of the civil rights movement of the late 1980s. And one of the things they were able to draw upon was that now that we've got the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, people who had been very guarded in talking about Martin, in telling kind of inside tales, talking about what it was really like, now are giving real interviews instead of these kind of sticky ones that they had given for years. And Garrow and Branch both soaked up those kind of interviews. And so we started to get a better historiography about Dr. King in the late 1980s. And then of course, this then just becomes a trend. This is what you caught in college because a lot of this stuff about, you know, the issues with regard to this plagiarism and sexual life and all that kind of thing, that all starts spilling out now then in the early 1990s. So then by then we've got a very real kind of warts and all kind of critical literature about all these topics. And as you say, then it became, you know, once the Radical King just becomes known, then even people like Cornel West and James Cone themselves, this is like, you know, mid-1980s, this started to happen, when even they began to come to terms with King in a way that's different than what they had said before. You know,
absolutely. Because, I mean, James Cone in God of the Oppressed, I mean, comes across as stridently opposed to Dr. King's approach. But you're right. I mean, you know, there comes a point where, I mean, that kind of opposition doesn't seem to be as prominent.
Yeah. You know, Cornell would say about this, he said, yeah, he says, for people like me for so long, Martin King, he was the one who died for us. And with a kind of patronizing drip, sometimes you say that, right? That was, yeah, he was that, but he's not someone we want to emulate. And we certainly don't think he was very radical. That was just standard fare. And of course, Cone, you know, if you're going to even say in 1969, what is radical liberation theology? Well, you got to accentuate the break from what just was. And Cone did do that. And it's only a kind of generation later, where now you're a whole generation removed from that sort of King tradition in that moment, that people like Cone and Cornell even were able to kind of have second thoughts about how they relate to King and what they say about him. And of course, in Cone's case, that's what produced his great book. I mean, it was this obsession of the 1980s. He did research on one book all through the 1980s, and it became his great book, Martin and Malcolm in America.
The first James Cone book that I read, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, by the time he's writing that book, now it's King and Malcolm. We've got them together. Each is a kind of corrective to the other, and each has got something that the other one doesn't have, and that's the one we need. And for Cone, then, for the next 20 years, you know, everything he wrote was just working this Martin and Malcolm dialectic, until quite late in his career. And he said, oh, actually, I need to work James Baldwin into that dialectic.
Yep. Yeah, Adam Clark is a friend of mine. So I've had talks with Adam about Cone's changing relationship with King. Because I'll confess, when I read Martin and Malcolm in America first and then went to God of the Oppressed, I was a little bit dumbfounded until Adam helped me to situate that in a timeline. And I said, oh, okay, that makes more sense now. You know, go ahead.
For God of the Oppressed, that book has a distinct importance in Jim's whole work. He wrote those first two books and, you know, got famous and came to Union and all that. But then he got pilloried, not just by people he didn't care about, but he got pilloried by people he cared about very much. Gayrod Wilmore and his own brother Cecil Cone and Charles Long and people who hit him hard on things that he took seriously. And now he has to save his vocation as a theologian. Am I in the wrong field? Should I, if I have these views, should I even be a Christian theologian? Should I just get out of this? That's what Jim was having to struggle with in 1971, 72, 73, 74. That's where he was. And when he wrote God of the Oppressed in 1975, that's the book that helped him make his Christian theology argument about why he's still very much a Christian theologian. He's going to mobilize a lot of these same arguments that he, from his earlier books, but now he's just got to do it in a way that secures, basically he's doubling down on being a Black Christian theologian. And that's a kind of response to the criticism he got. So far as Jim's theological career was concerned, that was just an utterly crucial text, even though in some other ways, as we are explicating here, he ended up going, you know, quite far beyond that book later on.
Right. Well, listeners, first of all, as you can see here, Dr. Dorian lives and breathes this history. It definitely comes across in this book. We haven't even reached Cornel West, who we've mentioned. We haven't reached the socialist feminist synthesis that he writes about at length. We haven't even, you know, touched on, although you've mentioned briefly, you know, the Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez phenomenon. All of these things are fascinating. However, out of respect for our listeners' time and Dr. Dorian's time, I do want to hear you comment on one bit from your final chapter in this book. You call the Senate, the Electoral College, simple majority elections inherently anti-democratic, and you call for their demise. Now, I'll confess this might be a function of my limited imagination, but the two ways I can think of to make that happen are either a constitutional amendment or a military coup. I don't think the former is all that likely. I don't think the latter is all that desirable. What are the third and fourth and fifth ways that I'm not seeing here?
Well, you know, there's certain things in the book that are, especially when you get that last chapter, especially that last section, where the work of a concluding part is not just to get up to what happened the day before yesterday, before this book went to print, which is, of course, so much the concern of that last chapter, getting right up to the Green New Deal and, you know, AOC and all of that. But there's also a certain kind of catching up with, okay, how certain things that have actually been in this story all along, this is how they're, you know, they're still there. And so this argument about the U.S. Senate, partly I'm just in kind of implicit way without pointing to it, saying, you know, this has been in the democratic socialist conversation all along. The first American socialist who was a member of the Congress, you know, Berger, was a, you know, this was as one of his standing proposals. We need to abolish the Senate. And the argument was always just the U.S. Senate is our version of the House of Lords, that it's a profoundly non-democratic institution that was put there expressly to be as non-democratic, as thinly democratic, you know, so thinly democratic that it really isn't democratic at all, as a kind of break on democracy. And it's there because that's the constitutional founders, not one of whom was a Democrat, you know, creating infrastructure that now we're still stuck with. Now that has been a trope in the Socialist Party all along. It's not like anybody makes too much of this. It's not, you know, that's not like anybody has a sort of fantasy. This is, we've got some path to it. And yet it is also, it is a way, I think it's nowhere near as important a way as the problem of white supremacism, but it is a part of the same issue, the same problem, that there are deep flaws in the constitutional founding of this country where there's something sort of baked in from the very compromises that went into being the kind of constitutional republic that we are in, that we do keep struggling with. That are in. As I say, I don't think this, you know, the existence of the U.S. Senate is anywhere near as important or as illustrative as the problem of white supremacy that's baked in where Black Americans just weren't even human beings. but you know, it is part of that problem. And so for the whole this whole course of American socialist history, socialists have sort of looked for ways of sort of illustrating, of saying to folks when they run for office. Norman Thomas was great at this, of just saying, you know, we can't just say, oh, we just want to go back to, you know, it's some Jeffersonian dream. There are certain things that are in our country's history that we need to rectify, that we need to pay reparations for, that we need to reorder, or otherwise we just keep reliving it out. Over and over.
Well, Gary, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about democratic socialism, about American history, about racism and anti-racism, about anything else as we head for the door?
Well, thank you, Nathan. I think the one thing I would say is that for most of my career, I was pretty lonely in this work. And I'm even aware, of course, that I developed a certain voice and style. And the fact that I've spent most of my career speaking every week on the road in small religious communities, I mean, you know, speaking at the in the sanctuary and just speaking to whatever audience you have there in a context in which neoliberalism just took over the world. I spent most of my career just giving talks against TINA. You know, TINA, there is no alternative. And just trying to lift up, no, there are alternatives to neoliberal globalization and all that it's, and these races to the bottom that it sponsors. But for most of my career, it was pretty lonely work. And I'm calling up the traditions, the histories that are behind the, you know, people who are doing the kind of work I do. And even I, we didn't talk about this today, but even I, there's a whole side of my work that's got nothing to do with all this. Because I also write high-flying books on Kant and Hegel and all that kind of thing. And a fair amount of that is just to sustain my own sanity, to just not always be, you know, knocking my head against a wall where the political circumstances are just so much running with contrary winds. And that's all my prefatory warm-up to say. That was the situation for most of my career. And I am aware that I developed a voice and even a character operated a certain way by virtue of always being in that space. Because now I'm self-conscious about it, because that's not our world at all any longer. I mean, not after Wall Street crashing everything in 2008, and the Obama campaigns and Occupy and Black Lives Matter, and then the Bernie campaigns and all that has sort of come. There are now enormous population groups, movements of people who know that neoliberalism is not working for most of us, and who realize that Black Lives Matter is just perfectly named. It's exactly focuses attention on what is lacking and what needs to be said in a country that's had the white supremacist problem every day of its existence. And now that we have these, we are in a political context that's just so profoundly different than the one in which I labored all these many years. It was a moving experience for me, and also one that I needed to always be kind of self-conscious about what I was doing writing this book, because I could have written most of this book, you know, a long time ago, and yet now I'm writing it in the context of this very different political moment that we are in, which is just chock full of peril, because I think politically we're in the worst crisis we've been in this country since the Civil War. But it's also one that's got an enormous opportunity. So that's that.
Gary Dorian, thank you for coming aboard for Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you, Nathan. My great pleasure. I'll talk to you anytime.
Very good. Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is American Democratic Socialism from Yale University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace. Go in peace, serve the Lord.